Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
In the fairy tale of Rip Van Winkle, a villager living in New York State in the 1700s wanders into the wilderness, falls asleep, and wakes up to discover a different world. His beard is a foot long, no one in town recognizes him, and something called the American Revolution has happened. He is a stranger in a strange land. Let's imagine a modern version of Rip Van Winkle, a man who dozed off in the year 1917, slept for a century, and woke to a drastically different world. One of transcontinental flights, pocket-sized supercomputers, political representation of women and minorities, and millions rising out of poverty worldwide. Our Rip Van Winkle would be shocked, fascinated, and overwhelmed. Luckily for Rip, if he needed to relax, there's one place he could go to immediately feel at home. School.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is March 20th. You know, I thought a fitting way to kick off the spring would be to share with you a conversation with Blake Bowles. He is the founder of Unschool Adventures, right? Spring, nice weather, time for adventure. Unschool Adventures is a company Blake founded in 2009. They run long-term international trips and U.S.-based retreats. The company serves self-directed learners ages 14 to 19 with a focus on building skills, experience, and confidence that a young person needs to transition into an independent adulthood. So with the nice weather here, let's talk adventure, I say. Unfortunately, where I am in Pennsylvania, we've encountered a real day after tomorrow kind of situation. Very unexpected, almost blizzard-like conditions here. And hopefully you remember the movie Day After Tomorrow, where the guy warns about climate change and nobody will listen to him, played by Dennis Quaid, by the way. And that movie is just more evidence that when it comes to, you know, climate issues or unsolved Hollywood murders related to insurance schemes, the Quaid brothers are just a step ahead of the rest of us. So when they speak, it's best that we just listen. Now, Unschool Adventures, that's only a part of my conversation with Blake Bowles. He has actually been on my aspirational list of School Sucks guests for over 3 years. And this week, you're going to hear two conversations. This first one is an introduction to Blake's work, the path he was once on educationally. Blake, good student, went to UC Berkeley, wanted to be a teacher, but then some things changed. There were some discoveries that impacted him, and they're going to actually sound pretty familiar if you've been listening for a while. Very interesting story. In the second episode, we'll be talking about his book, The Art of Self-Directed Learning, and a related article that he wrote for the Alliance for Self-Directed Education called What Does It Mean to Be Educated? So that's coming up this weekend. And you heard just a preview of that article at the beginning of the show today. Please visit the show notes at schoolsucksproject.com. Plenty of links to Blake's books, as well as his personal website, blakebowles.com. You can also check out unschooladventures.com. And May 11th through the 13th. That's a weekend, but not just any weekend. It's the third occurrence. I don't think calling it an event does it justice. The third occurrence of Renegade University and School Sucks Project present a weekend with Thaddeus Russell. It's going to be in New Orleans, Louisiana. And you go to ThaddeusRussell.com. It's right on the front page of his website if you want more information. And he will probably be back on the show in the very near future to discuss the aforementioned occurrence as well as some current events. So if you're interested in meeting up with us in New Orleans, ThaddeusRussell.com. All right, that's it, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. And Blake and I will be back with more at the end of the week. Take care. Well, we've already been talking for a half an hour. We're fast friends. We've never talked before, but I've certainly been meaning to have you on the show for years now. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. And School Sucks has been on my radar for a long time, too. So I'm honored to be a guest.
Now, how have we been on your radar? I'm curious.
There's not that many resource websites out there specifically kind of revolving around the problem of high school boredom and disengagement. And,
right.
And I know that you've been putting resources out there for a long time.
Yes, yes. We started with a very cynical approach. And then after a year, I think after the first year of the show, I got pretty worn down by that and tried to take things in a more constructive direction.
Yeah, I seem to remember a certain level of cynicism there in the beginning. I was like, oh, man.
Yeah.
They know what's going on, but oh man, it's a dark picture to paint.
Your work is really well aligned with what we do. I think the first thing I heard about you was this program you run, and I just want to lay this all out for my audience who's unfamiliar with you. You run this travel adventure program called Unschool Adventures. You're the author of a book called College Without High School, a self-explanatory title, but then another book called Better Than College, which is actually about alternatives to the four-year degree and everything that comes with that. You have another book called The Art of Self-Directed Learning that's newer. We're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But your story is wonderful. You weren't an unschooler. You were a good student. You, at least in the beginning, happily attended college at UC Berkeley. But here you are, I guess, about 15, 16 years after being a freshman in college, and a lot has changed as far as your attitude towards education.
You are correct.
So what changed? What happened?
I thought I wanted to be an astrophysicist, and that was also helpful because if you say that you're studying astrophysics at Berkeley, people tend to think you're smart.
Mm-hmm.
And as I actually met and interacted with graduate students in the astronomy department, I realized I was not going to make a good graduate student. I could also barely survive the higher level math and physics.
Yeah.
And so mentally, I went down to my backup plan, which was become a high school science teacher. I've known that I like to work with young people, especially teenagers. And I know that I like science and math. And so it seemed kind of obvious. And so I was operating on that assumption until I ran into John Taylor Gatto's books. And I know that you are a big fan of John Taylor Gatto.
Indeed.
I stumbled onto his stuff by total happenstance. I was taking a one-unit elective course about creating educational television. It was actually led by another undergraduate because Berkeley has a cool kind of student-led classes program. And so in this little class with 10 people, we were talking about creating like educational commercials that could, you know, help make people one iota smarter than they would have otherwise been.
Mm-hmm.
And then we all got pretty bored with that subject and just started talking about the school system and critiques that we've found of it. And the guy who was running that class just bought everyone John Taylor Gatto book with his own money because he said this is the most interesting thing that he's read, critiquing the system. And that book was just my gateway drug. I immediately went onto Amazon and found everything else. People who read John Taylor Gatto also read, you know, Grace Llewellyn, also read the Sudbury Valley School Literature, A.S. Neal, and down the rabbit hole. And I pretty much figured out within a few weeks that I needed to study this stuff full time. Alternative education, kind of critical education theory. And so I designed a major to study it full time, and that's what I did for my second half of college. And so I still graduated with a degree that has the least marketability of any college degree
right.
in existence. It's called Alternative Schooling and Science Education, and I created it myself.
What was the Gatto book you were given?
A Different Kind of Teacher.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, Not Dumbing Us Down. That's many other people's gateway drug.
That was mine. So I'm about 5 years your senior. So it was at the same time, but I was in graduate school. And I don't remember. I was like in the library. It was late at night. And I was doing like the initial steps in some kind of research project. And I don't remember what I punched into. I guess it probably would have been like Ask Jeeves, if not, you know, EBSCOhost. I kind of wish I remember the search terms, but I don't. But one of the entries that was returned was Schools Are Dumbing Us Down. It was an article, and it went to the book Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling. And at the time, I was late. I was stressed. I was lazy at that point in my life, certainly intellectually. And I kind of skimmed what was there. And realized that it wasn't helpful towards completing whatever project I was excited to be done with. So I closed the window. But I remember thinking to myself, like, some people think schools actually work against education. You know, like, wouldn't that be an unfortunate accident? Isn't that kind of a crazy thing?
Mm-hmm.
But that very brief encounter, it was like the arming of a time bomb in my mind, you know, because I went on to work with students. I spent a lot of time in and around public schools, private schools, you know, various state-run forms of education. And eventually, I think it was in 2007, I stumbled across it again and the bomb just went off because I was, you know, 4 or 5 years wiser, further in my career. I reflected a lot on my own student experience from working with, you know, struggling high school students again. And I was just way more receptive to the message at that point, which I think it was, I don't remember, against school. It was against school. That's what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. That was in Harper's. That was a great article.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. So what was it in A Different Kind of Teacher that really struck you?
The first paragraph, when he wrote that after 25 years of teaching, that schools and schooling are increasingly irrelevant to the great enterprises of the planet. And I loved when he said, no one believes that scientists are trained in science classes or politicians in civics classes or poets in English classes. The only thing that schools teach is how to obey orders.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this guy was this award-winning public school teacher in New York City, and when he writes about all the cool stuff that he did with his kids, which was largely hands-on and experiential, and the kind of stuff that if you were a fifth grader, you'd be like, yeah, I want to, you know, be with that teacher, because he'd like send you out to go do research projects in the streets of New York, you know, help you set up apprenticeships or, you know, make bend over backwards to make independent study options available to you. Like, he's obviously this wonderful teacher, and for him to turn around and say, like, after winning all these awards, I now, you know, utterly condemn the system that I've been a part of. That was just a game changer for me.
Absolutely. It makes it like a real minesweeper game that school reformers play, like trying to avoid him, you know, like trying to. I mean, people must know who he is, but he was never mentioned anywhere in graduate school. And I mean, it was, I remember being in graduate school and it was so constructivist. It was so idealistic. The professors talked like people from Sudbury, the model of education or these ideals for education that they had. And you think, I would have thought, you know, when I finally encountered this stuff, I guess 4 years after I was done with graduate school, this would have been useful to at least make it part of the conversation, because people seem to understand that there was a problem with the schools as they were. They wanted to create a vision of the schools for the future that did look a lot like student-centered democratic schools like Sudbury. But there was never any mention of existing criticism, and certainly no mention of Gatto. It was so bizarre. I only like skimmed this article, Dumbing Us Down, but it was such a bizarre thing to encounter in that context, that there's people who don't think school is good. And I think what got me years later when I stumbled across Against School, he said something like, do we really need school? I don't mean education just for schooling. And that was the first time in my life. It was 2007. So I had been a student who hated school for 15,000 hours for 12 years. I had spent 4 years in college. I'd spent all this time working with struggling students. And suddenly I'm faced with this revelation that there is a distinction between schooling and education.
Yeah, I had a similar moment. And when I started thinking about being a public school teacher and started reading all these other books, I asked myself, how long am I going to survive in this system?
Mm.
And I thought, God, this might end up just being a complete waste of my time and money to go into a graduate program and to become a licensed teacher. So that's when I started exploring alternative schools. And those were like the most interesting thing to me for a while, like the Sudbury Valley School as a model democratic free school, I think was for me and is for many people an easy way to kind of grasp this concept of highly autonomy based self-directed learning, because it still feels like a school. You see pictures of that beautiful granite mansion in Massachusetts at the Sudbury Valley School. I actually got to visit them despite, you know, how anti-visitors they are. I actually weaseled my way in there by plagiarizing their works in one of my classes and getting them really upset at me. But
really?
Anyways, yeah, I did it. And then when I apologized to them, I wrote them a little addendum and said, hey, I only did this because I really love your school so much. Could I come and visit you? And they said, oh, we passed your letter around and we decided to let you
visit, like with a very like harumph.
Right.
Air about it. So it is a beautiful place, and that was what really captured my attention for years, and definitely throughout that whole program, my self-designed college program. It was about alternative schools, but soon after that, my attention shifted, and I became much more interested in homeschooling and unschooling, and that's where they have remained.
I remember, I think I was there in 2013 or 2000. It was 2013. I was there. My friend and I went. And I guess they must have been having an open house because we had like free reign of the play. We could walk around. We could talk to students. And I remember there were a lot of things about it that I liked. And there were a couple things about it that I didn't like. But
wait. You can't just leave me hanging, Brett. What didn't you like?
I wasn't crazy about the discipline model. I wasn't sure that the democratic solution was the best option. Mm-hmm. And I was very much a purist as far as like this true autonomy in all forms. But it's very hard to have complete autonomy and also be part of a community. So the calculation I just didn't do at the time was like, yeah, if you want to be part of a community, which is a very normal human need and healthy human activity, you maybe sacrifice a certain amount of autonomy. It shouldn't be more than you're willing to sacrifice, but you give up some to be part of a voluntary community. And maybe that wouldn't have been the right voluntary community for me or for my children. But it worked for everybody who was there. I think I just, like I said, I had too much of a purist attitude about it at the time. The great news is that that model extends well beyond that mansion today. These types of schools are all over the country. I think I visited four of them during the School Sucks Across America tour. I'm 45 minutes away from one of them right now in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, called the Circle School. That was an awesome experience where they 20 kids came in, students and staff came in to meet with me and my friend Tony. We went and visited there in October. I was in Philadelphia on Saturday hanging out, looking for Toynbee tiles with the founder of a Sudbury school in Camden, New Jersey. This has been proliferated. Even though people use a general Sudbury model, the schools have taken many different forms across the country. And there are even forms that are adaptable to different communities, different cultures. I mean, Sudbury is all over the world at this point.
It is. I was just in Berlin visiting a school called the Democratic School X, which when we met one of the founders, he said, yeah, I got to visit Sudbury and to intern at a Sudbury model school in the U.S. And I came back to Germany where it's really hard to create any sort of school like that, like serious legal impediments. But he said that was his model. And so, yeah, Sudbury is an extremely powerful model and it is international. It's out there. So I'm really glad that it exists.
Absolutely. So back to you making this transition away from astrophysics and into self-directed learning. How was that for you? Because you probably felt like you were walking down a very unclear road at that point. Like, did you have any idea what you were going to do? Was it hard to let go of the idea and probably some of the comfort that came? I mean, I'm just, you know, injecting my own experience, but letting go of that idea and the comfort that came with that idea of going into the public school system, which is just a track that you're on, right? You're like, you're on those rails and you know where you're going for the next 30 years. And there was a kind of security in that. And as I really didn't feel like I could pursue that, graduate school taught me a lot about what I didn't want to do and surrounding myself with people who are already working in the public schools as teachers and seeing their frustrations and seeing their limitations. By the time they were 25, 26 years old and they were already like, you know, frustrated and questioning their career decisions, that was very educational for me. So there was enough motivation to go in a new direction, but I remember it was pretty scary when I did. How about you?
Well, I'd already had this first step of saying, well, I'm not going to do the thing that sounds most impressive, which is become an astrophysicist.
Right.
I will become a mere public high school teacher. But yeah, it's another giant leap to go from I'll be a public high school teacher, which is still a largely known and validated career choice, down to what? I'm going to go work at some alternative hippie schools. I'm going to there's no jobs out there beyond that. And even the alternative schools, the jobs are few and far between and extremely poorly paid. So maybe there was some anxiety, but honestly, Brett, I didn't feel it because I was on fire. Like my mind was turned on in a way that had never been in my entire life. And I was intellectually captivated. Like I could not not do this thing. And right. That's what pushed me. And I was not thinking of future career prospects. Honestly, during college, I was working at my childhood wilderness summer camp up in Northern California near Lake Tahoe as a windsurfing and kayaking instructor. And I loved that job so much that my whole plan for after college was to go work in outdoor education, essentially get paid to be a summer camp counselor year round. And that's what I did. And so I kind of knew what I liked to do for making money, and I can keep doing this alternative education, self-directed learning stuff on the side by just doing a lot of reading and writing. And that's what I did for a few years.
Absolutely. So you talk about being on fire, and you say Gatto was the sort of gateway to this. You mentioned a few other names, but what sticks out for you as being really influential or motivational that followed from encountering Gatto's work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first I'll tell you what was not inspirational.
Sure.
I immediately got led to all of the kind of old school education reformers like Ivan Illich, Paul Goodman, kind of people associated back with the 60s and 70s. And I found very little kind of accessible writing in those books. Even John Holt, the father figure of unschooling, I had trouble finishing any of his books, unfortunately. And so I didn't want to go in that direction. I think the Sudbury Valley School books, because they have so many books, are pretty good. But by far, the best story from one of those books was a story called And Rhythmatic. And I bet if you can Google it, you can probably get this story for free online. But that was a story about a group of kids, multi-ages, I think as young as 7 or 8, and as old as early teenage years, who approached a staff member at the Sudbury Valley School and said, "Teach us math. We want to learn basic math." And the staff member said, "You probably don't want to learn basic math. Your parents are just putting you up to this. Come back later when you're serious." Mm-hmm. They said, "We are serious. You will teach us math. This is your job, is to help us learn stuff." And Sudbury, as you might be familiar, they're very hands off. Like, they don't ever want the adults to suggest anything to the kids, which is something I disagree with. But I think it was perfect for this story. And so the staff member said, "All right, I'm going to use this really boring math book from 1898, and we're just going to do, incredibly boring repetitive problem sets, and we'll go as fast as all of you can get through the problems." And essentially, they did the whole math curriculum for what would be the equivalent of 5 years in the public school system, in a matter of 12 weeks.
Wow.
And that was one of the most influential stories that I read, because it kind of came at it from this efficiency argument or productivity argument. It's not just about, kind of being unhappy in school. It's about not wasting your time going at the same speed as everyone else, or being forced to study something at one moment when you have no interest in it, when you could be learning that same thing so much more rapidly and efficiently at a later time when you have a compelling reason to learn it. Even if that just means you've joined a little cohort of kids at a democratic free school who all got this crazy notion in their head that they want to learn all of math right now. That can be the compelling reason. The point is, there has to be a compelling reason. And so the Sudbury Valley School books were big for that. Reading the Teenage Liberation Handbook by Grace Llewellyn was major. And I'm just going to credit those two with the most influence on me.
Let's talk a little bit more about arithmetic, which I've actually never heard of. But do you remember anything about an explanation of the kids' motivation or their perseverance through a staff member who's obviously not excited about the process and probably having less than optimal materials to engage with that subject? What was driving them? Is that visible in the story?
No, I think it was just, these were probably kids who had never been to a normal school, or they'd been in Sudbury for a while. And I imagine that a very natural thing to happen, and I know this does happen at alternative schools and learning centers, is the kids there wonder, I wonder what the public school kids are doing today.
Sure.
And sometimes they feel a little jealous or bad, or they're missing out on something. And I think that's completely normal. Kids are very interested in the lives of other kids, and they compare themselves to their peer group. And so, I bet it was, I don't know. I don't remember from the story, but I bet it was just some kid's idea, like we should learn math. Yeah, that sounds cool. Let's learn math.
Right. No, it was interesting. I just flashback to being at the Circle School in Harrisburg, and the kids were so excited to tell me that they thought public schools sucked, right? Because that was the name of my show, and they just kept saying that through the whole meeting.
Well, so they're biased.
That was their interest in the public schools. And it was interesting, too. A lot of them had spent time in public schools, so they had some experience to reflect on. But that is interesting that a student must think of that system that everybody else is in, you know? Mm-hmm. And is there, you know, a curiosity about what am I missing being at a Sudbury school or some kind of alternative school? I really only got to interact with kids who had been there, done that, and left it behind and felt like they had found something much more satisfying and enriching in, you know, a Sudbury model school. So mm-hmm. That's interesting. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Moving forward, you make this transition for yourself, and you're doing a lot of outdoor education. Can you bring us up to the part where you create Unschool Adventures, and we can talk a little bit about what that is?
Sure. So outdoor education is more or less taking fifth graders hiking for a week and teaching them some basic science concepts. And I got burnt out on it. There was too much turnover. I felt like I needed a chance to have longer relationships with smaller groups of kids and to do more one-on-one work, which is what I love from my summer camp work. And so I was looking for other opportunities, and I found this really cool gap year position leading 18 to 21-year-olds on a 3-month program in South America. And I had recently come back from spending 3 months in South America, having quarter life crisis number one. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. And I wanted to go back, especially to Argentina, which totally stole my heart. And I didn't have money to do that. And I needed to have a job. And I thought, okay, if I could get paid to take groups to South America, that's perfect. And so I went through the whole interview process, and I thought I was going to get the job, and then I didn't. Mm-hmm. And I decided a few days later to email the director of the company who I'd interviewed with and say, hey, listen, can you help me just like start my own trip leading company? Because I really want to do this work. I essentially think this job is perfect for me, and you didn't give me the job, so I'm going to do it myself.
Right.
But I could only do that because I spent 2 summers at that point working at Not Back to School Camp, which is founded and directed by Grace Llewellyn. And I'd actually met these very large groups of teenage homeschoolers and unschoolers because these kids had mostly been figments of my imagination. I had come at it from a very bookish academic perspective, and I'd done a little bit of volunteering at alternative schools, but getting to work at Not Back to School Camp, which I was able to get a job there because I said, listen, I have summer camp background and I did this thing in college, and so obviously I should work here. And Grace ignored me the first year, and then she gave me a job the second year. Mm-hmm. And getting to meet all these kids is what made me realize that there are a lot of teenagers out there who are non-traditionally educated, and they love opportunities to connect with other teenagers face-to-face, and there are so few opportunities. And this is still the case. There are so many resources for homeschoolers and unschoolers who are little kids, and it just tapers off as you get older and older. Sure. There are more and more reasons to go back to school. So I essentially crafted my own company, Unschool Adventures, by throwing together a 6-week trip to Argentina. Grace helped me advertise this trip to the Not Back to School Camp community. And we got 9 people to sign up for the first trip, and it was profitable with almost no overhead. And I was like, oh my God, I'm getting paid to travel the world with cool teenagers.
That's awesome. So you say on the website that the goal of the programs is about building skills, experience, and self-confidence, basically to help a teenager transition into being an independent adult. What does that look like in action on one of these trips? Like, how are those things fostered in these adventure settings?
Yeah, I think the best way to do it is to compare it to 2 other types of travel that people are more familiar with.
Sure.
I think there's the typical kind of high school trip that might happen. Like maybe your school goes to Washington, D.C., or maybe you're lucky enough to have, you know, a short international trip. Maybe you go to Costa Rica, some safe destination. And as a high schooler, kind of every moment of that trip is scheduled for you.
Right.
And it all has to be educational, capital E educational, which means, yeah, museums and historical sites and somebody lecturing you about something all the time. And that is maybe fine for the very first time you ever travel with a group, but I think it quickly wears on kids. And I know it did for me the few times that I went on school trips. And so contrast that to what most people do who, let's say they're taking a gap year between high school and college, or they finish college and they're like, I got to go travel before I go get a job or go to graduate school. And they go and they essentially have a self-directed independent travel experience. They do the research on their own. They're managing their own budget. It's usually a very small budget, and they're going off and they're making friends at hostels. They're maybe planning some of their itinerary, but leaving other big parts of their itinerary open for spontaneous adventures and opportunities.
Yeah.
And so I essentially wanted to take that latter model of independent travel that's done by 20 somethings, usually could be younger or older, and apply that and give that opportunity to teenagers, because that more free form independent travel, when I got to do that, for example, spending 3 months in South America or going to Western Europe with my high school buddies when I was 19, that is what stood out as the most meaningful and the most kind of growth-oriented kind of travel in my life, way more than essentially the scripted vacations. And so I just said, there's no one offering these programs to teenagers. Most teenage travel programs are just a couple of weeks during the summer or maybe during spring break. And I'm going to take the kids who have the option to go on longer trips, who are the homeschoolers and unschoolers who are unrestricted by the academic calendar, and take them essentially to places that I think are cool and that I want to go to. And my own enthusiasm will come out in these programs, because I genuinely want to spend time here. It's not just me doing some same repeating trip to the same country. And so that's been the model, essentially. There are a lot of days where they essentially get to choose what they want to do. And we have safety protocols, of course. They're not just wandering around Buenos Aires by themselves. We provide the framework and kind of the overall, you know, here's where we're going, here's a few of our scheduled activities, but there's always massive amounts of free and open time for them to have a more independent experience than they could get with any other teen travel program.
So just a couple of detail questions. What does the role of the facilitator look like? Are you bringing people together like every day for some kind of meeting or some kind of review or sharing?
Yeah, we have, you know, we cook dinners together. We have evening meetings. We meet up in the mornings to figure out what's going on. And some days everyone has to do the same thing. I took a group to Southeast Asia recently, and there was a lot of travel days. And, you know, no one's going to opt out of the travel day.
Right.
That would not work. But then we get somewhere and maybe we spend 3 to 5 days there. And then in the mornings, it's like, all right, here are some options that the trip leaders are presenting. And I'm one of the trip leaders too, because I never want to become the office person who pays other people to have this good experience.
Right,
I want
to
be on the trip. And so we present options, and essentially they can choose to do the cool stuff that we're offering or to do something else, as long as they tell us what they're doing and take a cell phone and, you know, stay in a group of three people if they're going out far away. That's it. It's simple, and it works really well for trip leaders, because we are not constantly planning. We're not doing curriculum development and trying to make everything a teachable moment. It's just like we're saying, all right, how can we all enjoy this trip together? It's kind of like traveling as a family.
So when you started doing this, like the first trip you ever did, because you and I are both part of the like the kidnapped generation, you know, the white windowless vans. I don't know how much exposure you had to that, but that was like, I mean, today it's obviously worse with, you know, kids can't even go outside by themselves anymore, or it's like a Child Protective Services incident. But it was starting to change, like I think around the time. So yeah, it should have been a little bit worse for you. I mean, I guess it's all, you know, location and family dependent, but I remember having like just the ability to go out, ride my bike through the woods, be on my own, be unsupervised, like in elementary school. But towards the end of elementary school, there was this kind of over-reporting on, you know, dangers to children. And there was very much like I experienced during my childhood a kind of crackdown and like more restricted access to the world, as strangely enough, as I got older and more mature. I don't know if you had any residuals of that would have made you apprehensive about the immense responsibility of a group of kids in another country set free to explore.
I think I have an immense sense of responsibility to these kids and to their families, but it didn't come from fears about, you know, a child abduction. Mm-hmm. It came from working at these other places, these summer camps, where safety and risk management was taken very seriously. And it's just a highly self-selected crowd too. It's like the parents who are reading these trip descriptions and letting their kids apply for these trips are the ones who are already letting their kids do way more, giving their kids way more freedom and opportunities than the average kid is in the same age cohort. And so I think I've just been lucky to like tap into a really cool kind of highly dispersed network of families and really cool parents who say like, yeah, of course my kid should be able to wander around Buenos Aires, you know, with certain basic safety conditions met. You know, it's they're probably not going to get abducted. And so I've just taken advantage of that. It's a very small group of people who would ever consider sending their kids on one of these programs. And I'm not doing any convincing of anyone that, you know, that they really should do this. And it's really going to be fundamentally different from what they think it will be.
For me, if I had been you, like doing this work ahead of setting up Unschooling Adventures, that would have been really like transformative for me. Because as I put myself in your shoes and imagine being in that situation, I still feel a little nervous about it. And I think maybe that has a lot to do with the exposure that I had as a child and the things that I was told to worry about and, you know, the restrictions that I had to deal with. But it sounds like if I had had those experiences that you had had, I guess, in your mid-20s, working in all of these settings, these camps or with self-directed learners or unschooling parents, that just sounds like a really helpful experience as a setup for doing Unschool Adventures.
Yeah, you've got it.
It's interesting too. Like, you know, I was telling you before we started recording. I spent a good portion of last fall traveling, and the lessons that these kids are learning about this kind of free travel, this open experience. I was learning that like halfway through the trip. You know, there were places I had to be and people that I had to see, and my itinerary was very tight. And like a turning point was in St. Louis. A friend of mine, Kevin Cole, who's been on the show a few times, I met him and a couple other people for lunch. And I said, okay, I got to get on to Kansas City because, you know, someone's expecting me in Kansas City at 8 o'clock. And he convinced me, he said, you have to go see this museum. We have to go to this museum.
The city museum. It's incredible.
Right? Now, what happens when you get to the city museum is you find out it's not just, walk around and look at stuff at a museum. It is a maze, right? It is a maze that you start on like the 8th floor of an old shoe factory, and then you are lost in a maze. And it just
so
totally
cool.
Like reoriented me as far as like, you know, time and needing to stick to this schedule. I was like, all I have to do is make a phone call and tell somebody that I'll be there at 10 instead of 8. And I'm at the city museum lost in a maze. And that's fine. And, you know, that's just an anecdote. But it was really sort of an important turning point in presence, you know, and I think that that's something that these kids can get in a trip like this, that present moment awareness and enjoyment that the school trip just doesn't offer, you know. And I was very, very much like the first 10 or 12 days of School Sucks Across America, I was very much on a school trip, you know, like just one thing after another. Where am I going? What's the address? What time do I have to be there?
Self-inflicted school trip.
Yeah, absolutely. So the other thing too about Unschool Adventures is it's not just like enroll and you go on a trip, right? You're actually interviewing people and selecting people for this.
Yeah, I do Skype interviews with everyone and turn people away even when I'm struggling to fill up a trip. If somebody is not prepared or motivated to be on the trip, then sorry, got to wait for the next one.
What's the percentage of people you interview versus the people you go, if I can ask?
Yeah, I think that we accept about 80% of those who interview, because again, they highly self-select before they even get to that process. But you know, the last thing I want is to be in a foreign country with a teenager who doesn't want to be there because, let's say, their parents signed them up for it, or who is severely unprepared for that kind of independence, like who has never been away from home before. Mm-hmm. That's not a situation I'm going to put myself in.
Absolutely. I want to change directions a little bit, and we are going to do two parts, but there was a kind of orientation to your work that I wanted to do with my audience here in this first part. I wanted to talk about a couple of books that you wrote. The first one was called College Without High School. The second one was called Better Than College. And I was thinking, looking at those two titles and reading a little bit about each book, that there might have been an evolution in your thinking about college, where at one point a few years ago, you were saying that, you know, I mean, obviously, I don't want to generalize or be prescriptive. One thing is good for everybody. Obviously not. But the first book seems to suggest that, you know, college is a worthwhile destination. The second book is a little more towards, well, there's other alternatives here as well. Has there been a change in your thinking about the merits of college?
No. I think okay. that the books still kind of fit together. The first one says, if you hate high school, you can become an unschooler and you can still go to college, which will be a much more academically serious and just kind of serious environment in general. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that borne out in the homeschoolers and unschoolers I've worked with. The ones who are completely allergic to high school are happy and fine and competent in community college or in a four-year university. And I think the main difference is that people get to choose to go to college and people don't choose to go to high school. Better Than College was just about exploring kind of that subset of people who say, okay, while college might be a more serious place than high school, it still doesn't feel like the kind of work that I'm going to be doing there is the kind of work I want to be doing right now, or the price tag is just too big. And so I still stand by my belief that, like, for most young people, college is just going to be a better experience than high school is. So I wrote Better Than College when everyone was on this critiquing the value of higher education bandwagon back and started around 2010. Everyone was talking about MOOCs, massive online open courses. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote the book because there was so much material out there that kind of helped me write this book. There were so many other people writing about it. It made it so easy. But I don't think I've ever said that college is a bad deal for everyone, or that it's fundamentally, like, you know, not going to be a good experience in the way that high school is likely to not be a good experience. And I had a really positive experience in college myself. I would be hypocritical to say that, you know, nothing of value can be found in college. I just think that the economics are a much different situation. And that's usually how most people get into this. They're like, oh my gosh, I have to go how much into debt to have the privilege of this experience.
Right, right. So let's return to the first book and talk about that a little bit, College Without High School. Have you worked with a lot of unschoolers who did wind up attending college or
I'd
had
say
exposure?
The majority of unschoolers who I know end up going to some form of college. I think a lot of them use community college as a kind of way to test out whether they're interested in college level studies. And then if so, they can get either a few classes or a full associate's degree under their belt and transition into a four-year university. And so I think that's honestly, when I'm just racking my brain of all the teenagers I've known, most of them end up going to some sort of college. And so that's why I wrote the book, because I'd met all these teenagers, mostly through Not Back to School Camp. But I'd also run into these parents, mostly parents who I talked to about alternative education. And they'd say, yeah, but obviously you can't go to college if you don't have a high school degree. And I was like, no, there's all these kids over here who tell you, their experience tells you that you're wrong. And that's it. That was the whole reason for writing the book.
Was it typical that they would get an early start on the community college process?
Earlier than the average high school graduate, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
So yeah, like ages, I think 16 is the most common age to start dabbling with community college if you're a homeschooler, unschooler.
Yeah, that's awesome, because, you know, for me, I think it would have been a good choice for me to spend a year or two there. But I think there was a stigma, you know, I mean, and this really started around the time that I was graduating from high school, that if you don't go to college, you know, vocational education certainly had a separate stigma as well. But if you can't transition right from graduation, you take the summer off, and then you're a freshman at some college, you're a failure. Mm-hmm. That was certainly how I felt. You know, I remember, I think I mentioned this on a recent show too, a conversation that I had with my dad about, you know, really kind of trying to search and understand if this was the right choice for me. And, you know, his advice, the best he knew at the time, was, you know, I didn't go to college. I regretted it. I think you'll get a decent paying job that you won't like, but you're too young to care whether you like your job or not. You know, you'll make, I think he said, you'll make $10 an hour and you'll think you're rich. And there's a very good chance that you'll kind of fall into a comfort zone with that and you won't seek further education. So you just did 12 years, do four more. And one of the things that I wanted to do, I wanted to go on tour with the Grateful Dead. I knew that it was going to be a really tough sell. And then Jerry Garcia actually died, like, I think a month before my freshman year in college started. So that was out after that anyway. But that's about
timing,
where I was.
Time.
at 17, 18 years old. That's very cool that the unschooling provides people the freedom to get a jump start on at least discovering whether or not that's the right environment for them through community college or some other avenue.
Yeah. And just imagine if that was kind of the mainstream way to do it. You know, if compulsory education ended at age 14 or something, and then it was like, okay, there's highly affordable or totally free community college options, or you can keep taking classes on a sort of elective basis at the high school, or there's trade school, or you could just start working. I guess you're not really legal to work yet, but yeah, that would make so much more sense. And I've thought this a lot, and I've written an article about this. It just says, what if high school was more like college and you just gave everyone the choice to continue attending classes or not after a certain point? Is that really so hard to imagine?
Right. So is the book, and I apologize for not having read the book. I will tell you that I do have a note in my Evernote system in a folder called Future Show Ideas, and the note is called College Without High School, and it is a link to this very book that I created two or three years ago.
Oh, awesome.
I knew about the book. It was certainly on my to-read list. It hasn't happened yet. But I wanted to ask, since I haven't read the book, is it more anecdotal? Is it stories of people who've done this? Or would you describe it more as like a practical guide with, you know, executable steps?
It's both. It's very okay, cool. Executable, and it has a lot of anecdotes in it.
Awesome. Better than college. I think it's safe to say this because I think you're going to be done with this project before I actually get this show out. But before we start recording, you said you're writing a review of Brian Kaplan's book, The Case Against Education, right?
Correct. It'll be okay. On the Alliance for Self-Directed Education website.
And when is that due out?
Tomorrow.
Awesome. Okay. So it is right now, we started recording 9:30 p.m. on Tuesday the 13th. I interviewed Brian Kaplan 9:30 a.m. this morning and put that show out today. But since this is already that will already be published by the time anybody hears this, can you tell me a little bit about your assessment of that book?
Yeah, in a nutshell, he makes a great explanation and a great case for why signaling matters. And that means someone's work habits, productivity, their kind of sociability, and I love how he's so blunt when he uses the word conformity. He's like, employers want to know that you can conform. That is what you are showing when you say, I have a high school diploma or a college diploma.
Right.
And I think that's the best part of the book when he explains, no, school is not about building skills, and here's why. And he has these devastating arguments for why schools cannot feasibly be about skill building. And then he says, so what explains the rest of it? Signaling to future employers. Like, I am totally convinced and on board with his thesis to that regard. I think that he never addresses the possibility that somebody who technically does not have a high school diploma, like an unschooler, for example, you know, could still go on to do college level work. And I understand that he can't address all these little marginal cases in one book. It would be way too thick then. But he just never really considers non-traditional paths. And I think that he is a bit cynical about the level of sheer conformity that employers look for, because he talks about employers as this monolithic group of people. But there are certainly subsets of in career fields where a little bit of nonconformity, a little bit of I hate this phrase, but outside the box thinking is appreciated. And so I'm recording this right now in the middle of Silicon Valley, you know, obviously example number one. For a place where if you can code, if you can write good software, and it doesn't matter as much if you don't have social skills. It doesn't matter as much if you are weird and a little nonconformist.
Right.
You know, if you can make this program, then somebody else is going to make a bunch of money, and so they're going to hire you. And they'll probably figure, yeah, we can kind of massage the social skills, you know, the finer graces into this person. And so I think that there's a lot of counterexamples to just the, like, everyone wants you to be a diploma-holding robot, which is essentially what his book is saying. And, yeah, that's true in, like, if you want to work in government, if you want to work in banking, a lot of the healthcare fields, if you want to become a teacher, like, you have to jump through the hoops.
Sure. And he's seeing it through the lens of academia, too, which is certainly one of those conformist professions in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and that's an interesting discussion right there too. So I think that he doesn't give enough credit to kind of these outlier fields where you can get a job without traditional credentials.
Absolutely, yeah. And I, like I said, I could see it through the, like, it's a huge part of the labor market, especially healthcare. There's a, I mentioned it, there's a book called Discipline Minds. Have you heard of Discipline Minds by Jeff Schmidt? He's a physicist.
No, I don't think so.
And he talks about, you know, a lot of the higher education training for certain professions in the sciences and in healthcare as a, really a form of adjustment, you know, adjusting people, potentially creative people, potentially outside of the box thinkers to the status quo of that industry. And he uses terms like playpen critical thinking, playpen creativity, right? This idea that we will, you know, provide for people the illusion of free thought or exploration as long as it still fits in, you know, the box we need them to be in. It's called Discipline Minds. Hmm. But he was unfamiliar with the book, so maybe he'll pick it up. I think it would be, it's certainly a series of stories that would help his case. But I also agree with what you're saying, that it is a bigger picture as far as like the whole professional world. And yeah, you're right. There are a lot of professions where you are and elsewhere that do appreciate people who have the ability to think independently and creatively. So yeah, I was when you said that to me before we started, I was curious as to what your treatment of the book would be in a review. So we are going to do a second part. And in that second part, we're going to be discussing your book, The Art of Self-Directed Learning. But I really wanted to focus the show around an article that you wrote that lays a lot of really valuable stuff out. It's called What Does It Mean to Be Educated? So I really enjoyed that conversation. We got a lot done in an hour.
Yeah, me too. And I love that we can go all these different directions. You know, you're happy to derail temporarily.
I love it. I wish I could do more shows like this.
I think if we're going to talk about the What Does It Mean to Be Educated article, that's going to give us a lot to talk about.
Absolutely.
A lot of directions there.